ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I'm the great Ryan Last, and with that, let me introduce none other than the Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller.
Thank you very much, Brian. It's my pleasure to be here again today. Just always a pleasure to be in this seat and a pleasure to be able to talk to fans out there and to our listeners across the world and around the world. And just really got, I think we got a great program for them today. I'm gonna teach a little history here. Some people say I'm a pretty good wrestling historian. So today we're going to kind of tell people what it was like to move from one territory to another and why that happens and how these territories operate.
And I guess that's really where we're going to start right here. The last several episodes, you've been weaving the story together of the early days, the earliest of early days of your career in Georgia, but not everything lasts forever, and your time in Georgia wouldn't last forever.
That's correct. Actually, I guess it lasts about 5 months.
yeah, certainly not forever. Yes.
There you go. Way short of forever. But, you know, that was commonplace for young talent. You were lucky to get to work 5 months in one place because you didn't have the ability. A lot of guys didn't have the ability. In fact, I don't know anybody that just started and was good enough to go into someplace and be on top right away and be able to last there for a great period of time. So I get a call that a lot of wrestlers get. And it's business. It's part of the wrestling business. And it's a call from your booker usually, and he's the guy normally that is going to talk to you about this. And he says, you know, Ron, you need to come and see me. And he has the same conversation with my brother, but he doesn't speak to both of us at the same time. He's nice enough to do this with each of us individually. And I go in to see him, and it's Tom Renesto. It's one of the assassins. He has the booker there. He's been there for a considerable length of time, a couple of years at this point, I think. He has assimilated for the Georgia territory one of the best crews in the history of business, of the wrestling business, in my opinion. Just a fantastic crew. And I've been really pleased and honored to just be a part of it. So I go in not really knowing what he wants to talk to me about, but then he's very nice and cordial to me and starts off by being, you know, complimentary and, you know, you've done great here. You've got a lot of talent. You're going to have a great deal of success. I know this conversation well because I'm going to end up down the road having it with a whole lot of young guys myself when I'm in Tom's position or above his position and as the owner of a company. So I'm about to get a notice that my time is finished, that I have been there, I have done a good job. He would recommend me to other people. Where would I like to go? I get a volley of questions, and I'm not prepared. So I don't have answers for a lot of them, and I basically say, you know, Tom, thank you very much and for the opportunity, and I really think you're a great guy and you're super at what you do. And we exchanged some compliments And I basically leave there scratching my head. I've got 2 weeks, which is kind of customary back in those days, as you had a 2 week notice. I didn't have a family. I was lucky. I didn't have anybody to have to move. I'd recently married, so it's just a wife and I, and I don't have kids. I don't have to pull them out of school. Sometimes this is a hard thing for a wrestler because they wrestle and they move around the country so much. It's really difficult to move your family on a regular basis. And I got accustomed to it as a boy because my dad was a wrestler and he was a builder of businesses as well. And he liked to move. He became accustomed to that. And for pretty much my entire life growing up, I was accustomed to moving every 2 or 3 years. And so it comes time early on, 5 months in, I've had a nice little run there. We've actually worked with some tremendous guys, including Tom Ernesto and Jody Hamilton, the Assassins. Very lucky to get that opportunity. So I leave there scratching my head, where am I going to go? And my dad has a great relationship with Eddie Graham in Florida. Florida is a great territory. It's had big days already. It's been around for a long time. It was set up originally by Cowboy Luttrell. He had a lot of friends that he placed in certain towns in that territory, and it's close in proximity. I went played ball at the University of Miami. I have a little bit of reputation there. I feel like that maybe that's a good spot for me because they can play off my basketball, which is just in the past year. I mean, it's not like I've been wrestling for 10 years and away from basketball. I just finished my basketball career at the University of Miami, and now they may be able to utilize that some in helping me to get over and maybe stay longer in Florida. That's my wish as a young guy. Is gosh, I hope I can stay down there if I can get in there. And I have a conversation with Eddie, who is the man there. And he's known me for many, many years. My dad and I have been friends. Mike and my brother, Mike Graham, Eddie's son, and my brother and I have been friends for many, many years, made lots of trips, gone into the Bahamas and done things together. And it's a good fit for me. Eddie likes me, and Eddie says, we'd like to have you here. So it makes it easy for me. A lot of other guys might have a very difficult situation there. They might have only 2 weeks that they're going to be able to get a paycheck, and they may be out of a paycheck for 3 or 4 weeks. I'm not going to have to deal with that. I get a pretty well starting date. I may have 4 or 5 days off between the time I'm going to leave Georgia and the time I'm going to get to Florida. But I still have a great opportunity here, and it's a very smooth transition for me. And I'm very appreciative of that as a young guy.
I know you're a humble guy, Ron, but when you get your notice from Tom Ernesto, who was the booker for your father for years, in an office that your father owned a piece of for years, at any time, despite the fact that you're so humble, are you thinking, I can't believe they're giving me my notice right now?
No, I really didn't. I wasn't surprised because we didn't have really any other place to go. I'm pretty smart about wrestling because I've grown up in it and I've seen things for a long time. And we're two young guys. We're wrestling as a team. We very seldom wrestled as individuals. There's two teams there. One is Chotty and Fuji, who are still there. The second one is the monster team of the Assassins at the top. And there's not a lot of places to go. We've had a little run of 3 or 4 or 5, 6 weeks with Chotty and Fuji. They took care of us. We end up winning some matches there. And we worked our way up to wrestling the big boys. And now the big boys have pretty well done away with us. They've moved on to somebody else. And that's the way the business works. And it didn't really take me aback too far because I kind of saw that, who else have we got here? Where can we go from here if we're going to be teams? Now, if they would have split us up and singled us up, we might have been able to stay in there a little longer. But So I get this notice, and my brother gets the same notice. He makes a call in a different direction. He calls Nashville, and he talks to my granddad, Roy Welch. Roy's still in that office, still hammering away, one of the biggest territories ever built. And he talks to Rob, and he says, you know, son, you know, I hear you pretty good, and I'm going to bring you up here. Yeah, you can come there. We decide, I don't think I even discussed it with Rob. I wanted to go to Florida. He did not, I don't believe. He wanted to go to Tennessee. Here's a strange little deal as the end. We separated there. We did not wrestle as tag partners anymore. That makes it difficult for a young person. I don't know if I've mentioned this, but when you're a young wrestler, that tag possibility of working as a tag is much easier for you in the ring. If you've got to go in the ring and wrestle by yourself and be able to do everything you need to do and have a great match every night, that's very difficult. It's easier when you're in a tag combination, especially if your partner has got more experience than you have. Now, in our case, Rob had more experience than I did because he had started wrestling a year before I did. So he had that experience, and I had a little bit of a leader in there. But once you split up and you start wrestling in those single matches, then it becomes more difficult for you. And so the opportunity is there for Rob. He goes to Tennessee. I go south to Florida. And I thought, we might talk here just a little bit about for listeners out there and fans around the world about why wrestlers had to move and why was it necessary to move wrestlers so often that once they were in one place and fans got used to them, fans got accustomed, they liked them, they disliked them, whatever it was, depending on whether they're a babyface or a heel. And I thought maybe We'd discuss that a little bit about just what happens when they call you in and why they want to move you. And there's a lot of things that are involved in the wrestling and the sport of wrestling back in those days. And first thing they look at is they want a guy that they can do business with. And by that, I mean, they want a guy that when they ask him to do something, he's more than ready to do it. And there was a lot of people, a lot of egos in wrestling, and some of them are huge, monstrous. Is when I move on and start my own business, my own territory, and I'm running business myself, I find out how difficult it is to work with egos. And the bigger the star, sometimes the bigger the ego. So that's crucial matter right off the bat. Is what kind of businessman are they when it comes time to start talking about what's going to happen down the line? How far are they going to get pushed? How are they going to get used? All those questions come up for you. And if there's a clash of personalities, that can make or break a guy's ability to move up and the ability to make money in your business and in your territory. And the personalities, there's a few key people, obviously, here. The booker is number one, or the owner. Between those two, you have to have, if you have a clash of personalities early on with a booker or an owner of a territory, your chances of staying there very long is pretty slim. And most people could figure that out. You have to also be able to get along with the nucleus of the crew. You don't have to get along with everybody that's in there, but you need to get along with most of them because they want that happy atmosphere. I always loved it when I had my companies. I wanted that business, that dressing room that I love to go in because everybody is up and they're into each other and they're all talking and they're all captivated and they're all excited and they take that out to the ring. So it's important to have that atmosphere.
Ron, if I could take a step back, I am curious. You obviously went to Florida. Your brother went to Nashville. You put no consideration at all into the idea of calling your grandfather and going there or trying to go there?
No, I didn't. And the reason, Brian, is I did not want to use my family's family's position. I felt really lucky to get the shot in Atlanta, and obviously my dad was the owner, one of the owners there, and it was a natural fit. It was a natural thing because we were his sons. He's a star, and to utilize the sons actually gave him a little bit more of a push in a way because we could do six-man tags, which we did quite a few of, and all that type of thing. But I didn't feel comfortable with using my granddad to focus on my granddad and say, I want to keep working within my family. I could have gone to Nashville very easily, could have done very well. In fact, Rob went there and did fantastic. He actually made more money than I did. He did better there than I did in Florida. But I kind of made my own way in Florida. I wanted to be my own man. I didn't want to be a family man that had to depend on their family to continue to work. Also, there were things going on in Florida that I wanted to be a part of. The snake pit was developing there. And the snake pit, to me, was it enthralled me. I couldn't believe that they shoot. There's a group of guys that go in and shoot three, four times a week. And I wanted to be a part of that. I wanted to learn all aspects of the sport and not just what happens in the ring and what you're told, how to really do it, how to hurt people if you needed to, and how to get that reputation, because it's important for your future as a wrestler. So I chose that Florida for that reason, and secondly, because I didn't want to take advantage of the fact my granddad was an owner there, and it was easy for him to go, yeah, you can come here. You know, maybe he might have done that for Rob, even though they didn't have a spot. He might have just said, hey, it's my grandson. I want him in here. I didn't want that to happen for me. I felt like I wanted to kind of do it on my own.
Although you and Rob were split up at this point, you did have other family in Florida. The Welches, your cousins, were there at the time as well.
Yes. Now, I had Lester. Lester's down there, and he's been down there for a long time. Lester runs the Caribbean. He has his own little area. That's a strange territory, the way it's set up. There are individual owners of certain towns down there, and that's an unusual concept, too. And I want to get to that later in the program. I really want to focus on Florida. But since we're up here talking about why you move people around, yeah, I got a few more reasons that happens. Some guys just don't get over. Some guys have talent, and for whatever reason, they become stars in one territory, and they'll go to another territory, and they can't get off the bottom of the card. And there are certain things that make that happen. You know, one of the things is the reason I got my notice, they can be too young. I was too young. I mean, I'm not skilled yet. I'm not able to get myself over. I don't know how to get over. So I'm not going to be a top talent at my age. You can be too old and have the same problem. You've been around too long and people have seen you for too long. Or you can't do some of the things that you used to do, used to be able to do. You can not work out in the gym and you can let your body go to crap or you cannot go to the gym and you don't have a body. You know, there are reasons that you can't get over. Some guys are just not believable in the ring. What they do just looks bad and it doesn't look real. And if you don't overcome that as a young guy, you never have a chance. You'll never be big. So you've got you have to take all of that into account. Sometimes the fans just don't like a guy. For some reason, it's strange. And when you're an owner of a wrestling company, you need to watch every match. And I used to try to do that as much as I could. You need to see everybody's, how they are being accepted by those fans. Are they being booed as much as they should be? Are they being cheered as much as they should be? So there's a lot of things that go into why you let somebody go. And a lot of times In the case of most good talent, it's just because they've been there too long. And that sounds odd, but I'm sure if fans think about it, if they've seen some wrestlers that have been in their area for 20 years, 10 years, 5 years even at a time, they get to where it's like, oh, it's so-and-so on the card again. They're not excited about him anymore. They don't have the enthusiasm toward him anymore. And that's one reason that Booker's let guys go. That's probably a big part of it right there.
Did you ever have any experience with someone who you had to let go because they weren't over to the point you wanted them to be over, but they did not want to hear it? They didn't believe it. They insisted that everything was going great. And even though you're the boss and you're the booker, they're all of a sudden getting difficult.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, some guys see themselves as stars. They believe it. They believe they are. And whether they get over or not, I really believe that those type of guys, they're honest with themselves, and they don't want to be honest with themselves. But if they are honest with themselves, they would say, geez, I'm just not getting it done here. And when you go and talk to them about it, you're going to get that. That's the ego part of it. It's part of being wrestling. It's part of being a wrestler. It's part of what you are inside, and you've got to really believe in yourself if you're a professional wrestler to ever become a star. If you don't believe, who the hell else is going to, is what I used to say. You've got to have it in you that, hey, I can do this. Well, they all felt like that. And when you said, hey, look, you're just not getting it done, it's like, whoa, you kidding me? I'm great. You know, I get over everywhere. Well, you're just not getting over here, you know. So, you know, you had to. I always tried to be really nice about it because you hated to let people go. But at the same time, if you're trying to run a business, you've got to have the best crew you can put together to do the best business that you can do. And you not only owe that to yourself, you owe that to all those wrestlers because they're paid off of how well you draw. So you run a good company and you run a good business, everybody's happy and everybody's getting paid well, and they kind of depend on you to make those decisions as to when a guy needs to go and when he needs to be replaced and when he's not. So that, for wrestling fans, you know, maybe they'll get a better idea of why maybe I get the notice. I'm young. I'm pretty sure that it's because I'm young. There's several reasons. I'm certainly not there at that point. Most professional wrestlers are going to take 5 to 7 years before they actually find themselves, I call it, before they actually hit upon what's going to make them draw money. I didn't do it. I was lucky. And I think a lot of it is because I came from a wrestling family, and I'd probably seen 10 times more wrestling matches than anybody that started that wasn't from a wrestling family. And I kind of saw what guys did that made them get over. And you pick up little pieces from this guy and little pieces from that guy. But it takes a while to put it all together. And I was lucky, around 3 years in, I start getting shots in St. Louis, and once I go to Australia, I get to wrestle people, guys from all different parts of the world, and I come back a different wrestler. I make it happen in 3 or 4 years rather than 5 to 7 years, and I was lucky in that respect, and I made some good decisions about trips out of the country and trips to places that I knew I was going to encounter new styles and different thoughts and whole different actions in the ring and moves that I had never seen before. All of those things go into making your product, and you as an individual are your product. All right, what can you do to make a promoter want you?
And I've heard that working for Eddie Graham in Florida specifically at this time was like getting your master's degree in how to put everything together. The fact that you had everything together, from what you're saying, by the time you got to Knoxville, you felt confident you had everything together.
Yes, because I was lucky. I was lucky, Brian. I picked the right place. I went to Florida, and gosh, Eddie was a master. Eddie was one of the most brilliant wrestlers and owners that ever lived. He's phenomenal, and he runs his business in a manner that not many people did. I go to Florida and I learn to wrestle. Rob goes to Nashville and he learns to fight. It's that different. I mean, Eddie's business is based upon being solid in the ring and a lot of wrestling, good technique, beautiful moves on the mat. Rob don't go. They don't care in Nashville. Half the guys can't wrestle at all. They don't know any wrestling. To imagine having a snake pit in Nashville is just outrageous. You know, there wouldn't be one guy that would go to a snake pit in Nashville because they don't care about shooting. You know, they want to do what they do, and they don't want to. It's harder to wrestle and get people, the fans involved, than it is to go out there and fight, get the fans involved. And Eddie's way was more difficult. Matches had to be longer. They required a lot more work. They certainly required a lot more wrestling moves and wrestling technique. And, you know, the prime example, his champion is Jack Briscoe. I mean, you need to say no more. I mean, you know, there's a guy that he's the epitome of real wrestling. He's from not only from wrestling, he is wrestling, by golly. He is the national champion in college 3 years in a row. Only lost one amateur match in his entire life. He's as tough and as good and a perfect guy to represent your company if that's the direction you want to go. And that's the direction Florida was going.
I want to ask you how often, because you and Rob were close, how often did you guys actually stay in touch during this time? But you just hit on something I want to ask you about. Georgia had a great crew, but Florida had a great young crew. And you're really entering the territory at a time where you have Jack Briscoe really starting to hit his stride. Dory Funk Jr. is coming in and out all the time. Rhodes and Murdoch, the infamous Texas Outlaws, they're in Florida every single night. So what was it like for you to be in that locker room where a lot of the guys seemed to be closer to your age than they were in Georgia?
It was spectacular. I loved it. I just loved it. And we traveled together a lot. Back in those days, wrestlers traveled together a lot. Nowadays, and as time goes by, you're flying and you're separated and you ever go in different directions and all that stuff. Back in those days, you're all wrestling in the same town on the same night, and you're driving and riding together with them. And there was a phenomenal base of young talent in Florida. And Eddie, you got the perfect guy that's sitting on top of all of that and encouraging guys that come in the snake pit and come and do these things and get more involved and go to the gym. And he had all this tremendous perspective about how to run a company. You didn't get that in Nashville. Nashville was an older promoters. It was guys that did not, they weren't based. Their business wasn't based on solid wrestling like Florida was. And when I used to go, and I talked to Robert quite a bit, and as time goes by here, we'll get the trips that I made to Tennessee and actually wrestle with him up there. And the crazy things that went on as compared to what was going to happen down there in Florida, it was totally different. It was a totally different sport in Tennessee than what it was in Florida.
Well, we'll pick up the story in just one moment, Ron. But before we continue with the program, a few words about the next Super Studcast, which debuts on Sunday, March 11th, 2018 at patreon.com/studcast. Let's go to this right now.
The Tennessee Stud has set the podcast world ablaze with his unique concept of an honest and insightful deep dive into wrestling history. With his Andre the Giant and Ron Wright Super Studcast, he began with one giant of the sport and followed with the introduction of another, less well-known but just as interesting. In Super Studcast 3, he moves from personalities to places on our planet. The Caribbean is a magnificently beautiful chain of islands and countries stretching thousands of miles off the southeastern coast of North America. Some living within this paradise have always been known for strange rituals and cultures, and the Stud personally believes that this is one reason why this forbidden zone is known as the Devil's Triangle. Super Studcast number 3 will take you inside the Devil's Triangle and expose you to a wrestling world as unimaginable and alien as anywhere on the planet. Get ready to be astonished and amazed by what you hear. It can only be appropriately described by one who has experienced it and just happens to be one of the greatest storytellers of all time, your Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. This is why they call these two-hour experiences Super Studcast. Now, sit back, prop up your feet, close your eyes, and imagine the breeze rustling through the palm fronds as we begin the ride 90 miles off the beaches of Miami in Nassau, Bahamas. This is Super Studcast number 3.
There it is, the next Super Studcast discussing the Devil's Triangle, the Bahamas and the Caribbean Islands, debuting Sunday, March 11th, 2018 at tnstud.com, also patreon.com/studcast for only $2.99. We'll have more information about that at the end of the program. But Ron, as we pick things up now, you're in Florida, Rob's in Tennessee. Did you ever think that that was the perfect scenario? Like if the roles had been reversed and Rob had gone to Florida and you had gone to Nashville, your career never would have turned out the way it had.
It would have made him, it would have made me a different wrestler. Yes, it would have changed my style. And I developed more of a wrestling style. And it was because that's what they wanted. It's because of the training that I got. And I'm going to get highly involved in the snake pit. And we're going to talk some about that soon, Brian. I'm kind of chronological here, and I really kind of want to stick with that. So I really have a tendency. I want to go right to the snake pit, you know, because it's great stuff. It's phenomenal stuff, and it gives people a feel for what Eddie's all about and what that Florida whole operation is all about. But I thought maybe we might change this a little bit and talk a little bit about the specifics of the Florida territory. We're going to get into all these other things later, but I want to kind of let people know the landscape here. What does this look like? What does Florida look like? Now, you've got the owner. You have several owners in Florida. You've got Eddie. You've got Eddie's brother, a young guy. He owns a little piece. You've got Duke Kiyomuka. You've got Lester. You have several different entities here that are big owners, bigger chunks, smaller chunks. I'm not so sure Don Curtis is not one of these people. You know, there are some things that I wasn't privy to back in that time. So, but you've got your ownership and your partners there, and you've got your local promoters. You've got in Orlando, as an example, you have Milo Steinborn. And I don't know how familiar you are with Milo Steinborn. That's Dickie Steinborn's father, obviously. A phenomenal, one of the strongest humans ever lived. Truly, just magnificent strength person. Feats. I used to read some of his stuff when I was in Orlando, and he actually somehow he owned portion of Orlando. I don't know exactly what portion of Orlando he owned, or whether Eddie and them were involved in it, or whether they just got a booking fee. I wasn't privy to a lot of this stuff because I'm a young guy and I'm just happy to be on the cards. You got Milo in Orlando that has certainly paid his dues. He's getting older. Dickie, his son, is going to become one of the great workers of all time is Dickie Steinborn. Just a fantastic, fantastic worker. You have a guy named Pat Kelly who is in Fort Myers. And I wrestled a whole lot for him. Pat must have liked me. And he, right on the beginning, as I went there as a young guy, like, and you mentioned, with a lot of other young guys, Pat took particular like to me and used me on top in Fort Myers. And I drew him a lot of money there. I got to be a big star there first. The first city I ever, I guess, became any kind of star in was Pat Kelly's Fort Myers. Lester is in charge of the Caribbean. Lester runs the Caribbean. I don't know that he owns it or how this all works with that, with Eddie and those guys, but Lester promotes Nassau. He's going to promote San Juan. He's going to promote Freeport in the Bahamas. He is the guy that's going to run to the Bahamas. He's got an airplane, and that saves the company money. So he's going to fly half the crew or some of the crew into these cities and countries down there in the Caribbean and save that airfare. Just the big boys are going to get to take those commercial flights. So you've got that all going on. You have to have somebody, and these owners, they have to handle all kinds of different things. You got TVs that they're responsible for getting on the television, for making a great television product, for handling the buildings. What buildings are you going to run in Miami? What are you going to run in Jacksonville? Where are you going to have your matches? They're responsible for the accounting, keeping up with how things are going and where the money's at and how they're doing in certain areas and how they do in the north part of the state compared to the southern part of the state. Expansion, do we, in their case, they got the Caribbean sitting out there. There's nobody there. You know, how much do we want to go to the Caribbean? How often? Where do we want to go in the Caribbean? There's a lot of islands down there. There's a lot of countries down there, a lot of potential down there. And they got to figure all that out. The owner's got to look at all these pieces of the puzzle, and then he has to have a relationship with his wrestlers. He wants them to like him. It's important to be in a company in which your guys, your crew really wants to work hard for you. They want to produce in the ring. They want to go out there and give for you. And that's important. You got to create that as a wrestling promoter. You have to create a relationship with your talent. You want to be friends with them to a point, but to a point, there is a point that you don't want to become so friendly with them that you can't communicate with them as an owner rather than just one of the guys.
So many people, when they think of a territory, for this instance, let's say Florida, they think Eddie Graham. Eddie Graham was promoting throughout the state. They don't think necessarily about local promoters. How important was a healthy relationship between the office and the local promoters, and what would happen if that relationship would fall apart?
There's a good question. It was extremely important because basically Eddie has got an office in Tampa, and the wrestlers basically are wrestling. Their commitment is to Eddie. He's the man, and everybody recognizes that Eddie is the man. So if Eddie sends you someplace and you don't get along with that promoter, and you have a problem, you go back and you talk to Eddie, it can develop into a mess. And you don't want to have that happen. Eddie had great relationships with these local promoters because Eddie had gone there himself as a young guy after wrestling a lot in New York for Vince Sr. and Vince's grandfather, I assume. You know, he was there way back in the day when, you know, wrestling was just getting cranked up with the WWF. And when he went to Tampa, he's still a fairly young guy. And Cowboy Luttrell takes him under his wing and teaches him the ropes. And, you know, Eddie knows these guys. He's worked with them and for them for years before I get there. Their relationships are solid. And if they're not solid, what happens is Eddie don't go, they go. You know, it's pretty simple. You know, if Eddie can't get along with you, he's providing you with the wrestlers. They didn't have their own wrestlers. They just had a town, and they said, send me your wrestlers. And if they don't get along, then it's pretty easy for Eddie to pull the strings and say, hey, you don't have a card. I don't have anybody to send you for next Monday night in Orlando. And Milo would be going, oh, my gosh, man, what are you? I'm out of business. So it's a really little tightrope that you had to walk as one of those local promoters. But they had that great relationship with Eddie, and Eddie was a He was a great guy. His handshake meant something. He was honest, and he did not lie. He would look you in the eye and tell you whatever he thought. You were going to get a true assessment of what he thought of you. If you asked for it, you better be ready, because he's a really honest guy and a killer. I mean, an absolute killer when it came to taking care of the business and standing up for the business, and a Mark jumping in the ring or whatever it might be. Eddie was a madman, and we're going to get to some of that madman stuff. We get into the snake pit. That's where a lot of that really came to life for me. I saw Eddie from a whole different perspective.
And of course, we're going to get there, and people have heard little tidbits, little stories about the snake pit over the years, but you're really going to be the first person to really go in depth and dive into the snake pit and tell those stories. But just a couple more questions about local promoters, Ron, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
How much leeway, if any, did local promoters have in setting the card? Or was the card always just handed down from the office? And then to what you were saying before about if the relationship does break down between the office and the local promoter, the office can say, hey, we're the booking office, you won't get any more talent. But what about when it went the other way and the local promoter can say, hey, I've got the relationship with the only building in town. I've got the relationship with the local politicians. You're not coming into this town anymore.
I've got a great answer for you. I am the answer. When I went and started my company, Southeastern Wrestling, I bought it from John Kazana, who had been there, the Kazanas, he and his brother, for many, many, many years. I don't know, 20 years, maybe more. And their relationship was with Nashville. Nashville sent them talent. Now, they're pretty lucky in the respect that they have some local talent there that Nashville doesn't use on a regular basis. And they happen to be the Wright brothers, Ron Wright and Don Wright. Pretty darn good boys. There is another guy named Whitey Caldwell that's a pretty darn good boy. And so if John Kazana, who I bought the business from, I got in the same position he did. I go in there and I'm getting some of my card from Nashville, and they're substituting me to death, and they don't have really good talent sometimes. And I'm using Don and Ron. Whitey has died. He's been in a car wreck. He's not available to me. And I start to have problems with them that I don't like what they're sending me. And I just called him up. I talked to Nick Gulas, which is Roy. That's my grandfather's partner. And I had a conversation with Nick several times and said, Nick, you're killing me here. You don't send me. You let me book guys, some of your top guys, and then you don't send them to me, and you send me a substitute that's some jabroni that can't work, and he doesn't, and he's not going to go out there and have the match that I should have had from the top guy that was booked. And it's costing me money, and my town is, instead of growing, it's dying. I had all these things that I tell him, I said, you know, I can't, and I paid him 10% of the gross. Whatever the town drew, he got 10% for sending the talent. I had to pay those wrestlers, but he got a 10% of what I made there, what I had there. And I had the issues so much so that I eventually said, I'm not paying you anymore. I don't need your guys. I went down and talked to Jody Hamilton out of Atlanta. I went and talked to Rock Hunter. I went to talk to several other people. I had Les Thatcher that was wrestling for me some. I had a great group of guys, Nelson Royal. I had some pretty decent talent that wanted to wrestle for me. They liked me. They knew me. And they came in and started being there every week for me. So I just basically cut my ties with Nashville and said, I'm no longer one of the towns that you supply talent to, and you'll no longer get booking from me. It raised a lot of stink in Nashville for a while, and I survived it. They weren't in position to come in. They weren't in position to get on another television. There wasn't a lot of buildings there available to have matches in. For whatever reasons, they decided to let me do what I wanted to do, and they took Knoxville off their major map.
And then the cards. Do the local promoters have leeway to put a card together specific to the town, or is it coming directly from the office?
Now, that pretty much came from the promoter. Now, they said the way this thing worked is John Kazan, as an example, before I went to Knoxville, would say, who can you give me? And Nick or whoever in the office that handled that portion of it would say, I can give you Rossi, I can give you Len Rossi, and I can give you Lester Welch, and I can give you, and then they might give you five guys that aren't good at all. And it's up to you to book them. You decide who's going to wrestle who and who's going to be on your TV. Yeah, you were lucky if you got really good talent for your TV. Those guys had to say, who can you send me for TV? Not just who can you send me for Friday night? Who can you send me for Saturday to wrestle on my TV? And it was a really bad combination of things, factors going on here. They might have sent you a guy that's a great guy to wrestle on TV for you, but he can't wrestle for you next Friday because he's booked somewhere else. So you're in a real bad situation when you get your talent from somebody else if they don't want to take care of you. Now, Milo in Orlando and Pat Kelly in Fort Myers, Lester in the Caribbean, they're not dealing with this. They all get the crew. They get all the wrestlers. But Nashville is such a humongous territory. It's just spread everywhere that you can't send all your good guys to the same town. So they spread their talent. I think probably back in this 1970 era, Nashville might have had 150 wrestlers in there. There was times that guys used to complain that when they got ready to pay, they said you had to stand out in the street because the office was full, and guys would wait to get in to get their money. It was a huge territory, and it was not run as well as it should have been.
And when it comes to Florida, we'll get into a little bit more about who was in the office. But before we get there, we've talked about local promoters and what they do, Ron. What about the booker? We talk about the cards that are being sent in to local promoters. They're coming from the office. That means they're probably coming from the booker.
Yes. Now, what happens here is Florida's different. Now, Nashville, they're going to send you the wrestlers over there. It's your responsibility to do what you want to with them. They're going to send a group of wrestlers down there to Birmingham. It's going to be the same way. They're going to send a group of wrestlers on that same night. It's going to be somewhere out in West Tennessee or maybe in Arkansas or Missouri or whatever state they are. And they're not going to have a booker that goes with them. But in the case of the way Florida ran, is the booker went. The crew went and the booker went. And the booker booked your town. Milo didn't want to. I don't know that Milo even wanted to say, hey, I want to figure out what I'm going to do next week. I want to work on the matches and figure the matches. I think he was probably very happy to get a darn good crew and a booker to tell him what to do and to make sure that they're going to draw money the following week. And it was a different operation in Florida, significantly, than what it was in Nashville.
And what about in Florida, the booker at this time?
At this time, it was Louis Tillette. Louis Tillette was booking there. Leo Garibaldi was booking there. When I first went, Leo is going to be replaced by Louis not too long after I go in there. Leo Garibaldi is the booker that was in Georgia prior to Tom Renesto, who brought in a great group of talent with the Torres brothers and the Vachons. And Leo was a great booker, and he had a lot of bookers had great crews. They had these guys that would follow them, and when they got the job, they would change their crews significantly. When Leo got that job in Florida, he no telling got rid of who, and he brought in his people. He brought in his guys that he liked. It was kind of like my dad when he built businesses, starting with the Gulf Coast and into Memphis and on into Arizona and then coming to Atlanta. It was the Sputnik Munros and the Mario Galentos and the Joe Scarpas and the Jose Lotharios. It was the same kind of, they followed him. They went with him. And that's a great, that was a working pattern. It worked very well because they knew the Booker very well, and they were confident that he's going to keep them. They're confident that he's going to let them do what they need to do, which is exactly what has to happen. You have to feel like that this is a place I'm going to be forever. And as long as this guy is booking here and that he's going to use me well, they felt comfortable with him. He felt comfortable with them. He knows what they can do. He knows how they can get over. He knows how they can produce. It was a great combination. So when bookers change territories, talent changes too at the same time. And that brings fresh faces. It makes things a heck of a lot better for everybody usually.
Leo Garibaldi would replace Louis Tolette again a few years later in Los Angeles, where Roddy Piper got his big break at the hands of Leo Garibaldi as a booker. But we'll talk more about the booker, the commentator, the office, the operating staff, and so much more in the Florida office when Ron gets there in the fall of 1970 on the next Studcast. But first, we have a few questions that were sent in from listeners. Are you ready for these?
Yes, sure, man. I love the questions. Let's do it.
We got a couple of good ones here. The first one is from Scott Brown in Detroit, Michigan. What are your thoughts on Dick Murdoch, and do you think he could have been world champion?
Jason, I know quite a bit about Dick Murdoch. We just spoke already a little bit about him. He was there in Florida when I went there, and he and Dusty were the big tag team. Both those guys, gosh almighty, those are very talented guys, both of them. They were a phenomenal team together, but even separate, as they separated and Dusty went on his way and Dick went on his way, Dusty becomes a monster. He's fantastic. Dick is a very talented wrestler, a tough guy, a big son of a gun, a Texas boy, just like Dusty. And I wrestled Dick so many, many times. I have so many stories about Dick. One is that I was getting a cauliflower ear about 7-8 months into Florida. My ear was starting to cauliflower, and it was swelling every night, and it was painful. Cauliflower ears are a really painful thing to get. And some guys nowadays, they all go drain them. They get the needle stuck in there and they pull the blood out and they don't want a cauliflower. I kind of wanted a cauliflower. My dad really wanted me to have a cauliflower ear. And I've just about, he insisted, boy, you got to have a cauliflower ear. You're going to be a wrestler, right? So, and my granddad had two of them. Both of his looked like taxi cab going down the street with the back doors open. He had big, bad cauliflower ears. So I'm in a boxing match with Dick Murdoch in West Palm Beach, and Dad goes over there and says, you know, the kid's got a half a cauliflower, and I need you to whack him in that ear tonight, man. I want him to get the big deal. I want him to have the cauliflower. And so Dick Murdoch, I remember the match very well, a boxing match. We fought for 10 rounds. And that's hard when you're a wrestler to fight in a boxing event. It's difficult. You're not used to doing it. And I remember about after the 8th round, the bell rang, and we were in opposite corners. And I walked past him to the corner, and my left ear was the one that was swollen. And he hits me in that ear so hard. Oh, my gosh. It was so painful. I didn't go down. I couldn't go down. I just stiffened like a board. And I walked stiff-legged to the corner like, oh, my gosh almighty. And that ended up being my cauliflower ear. That's one of my thoughts of Dick Murdoch. Dick, I don't know if Dick would have made a great world champion. He was not the talker Dusty was. For one thing, Dusty did a lot of their talking, and Dick was like attitude. I guess it would be attitude. For me, he was a little more difficult to work with than Dusty was. And I don't know if other guys felt that way or not, but Dick was a great worker. I'm not taking anything away from him, and I believe he came from a wrestling family as well. And he paid his dues. He was a great talent. He was a great talent. Wherever he went, he drew him money. I have no doubt. But I don't know if he would have made a great world champion.
It's been said that one of the things that would have probably prevented him from getting the votes to be world champion is that on his good nights, he was possibly the best wrestler in the world. On the nights when he decided to be silly, he was the silliest wrestler in the world.
Yeah, he liked to play. He really kind of liked, he enjoyed playing in the ring. And you can't have that attitude. I'm going to talk in this upcoming next Super Studcast about the Bahamas, and I got a great match to talk about, a Kill the Town match with Dick Murdoch and Dusty Rhodes, and I'm involved in it. I'm there, and we actually killed Nassau. They killed Nassau. It wasn't me. And we're talking. You talk about playing. If you want to listen to that Super Studcast about the Bahamas, you will hear a story about a match that's just, people will go, I can't believe that. It's truly remarkable what some guys could do. And that was an instance of where Dick just took it to an extreme. And so it's crazy. That's a great question, though. Dick Murdoch is a great guy, super athlete, great wrestler. But I'd never heard that before, Brian, but that's pretty good assessment of where he would have been as world champion and what may have kept him from getting there.
Well, one of the things in this question was asking if he would have been a good world champion. You're someone who eventually got to vote for the world champion. You rose to the rank of vice president of the National Wrestling Alliance. What was it like to vote for the NWA world champion? And did the guy you wanted to be the champion always win that vote?
You know, it never happened. It did not occur that often, because when you think about it, there weren't a lot of champions. They didn't switch the belt every 3 months or every 6 months. Usually a guy gets it, he's going to keep it for a year or maybe even more. I don't remember a lot of switches that occurred in less than, say, a year's time. So you didn't sit there and vote too often about, you know, hey, is this guy the guy or is that guy the guy? It didn't come up that often. It was kind of a political thing to be world champion as well. You had to have backing. You had to have quite a few prominent guys, that the NWA promoters that had been there for a long time, they had a lot of respect among the members, and their feelings carried a lot of weight. So, you know, there, it was more than just what you thought personally. It was sometimes what others that you respected thought, and you kind of could be swayed in one way or another, depending on who liked them and who didn't like them. So it was an odd thing. I never had the opportunity to be as a part of that much, just simply because it never happened that much.
What did you think about some of the short-term title reigns during the period that you were a member, whether it be Giant Baba's brief turns, Dusty Rhodes, and of course, most notoriously, Tommy Rich in 1981?
I thought that those were politically motivated. They were done to, in the case of Tommy Rich, maybe because of what was going on in Georgia at the time, might have had some influence on that. I did not personally like that concept of let's put a belt on somebody for a week and the champion gets beat the first night in, champion wins it back the last night out. You know, that type of thing to me did not make a whole lot of sense. And a lot of that was not promoted across the country. People didn't know in Washington State, as an example, probably that Tommy Rich was ever world champion. And in America, not many people knew that Baba was there. You had to be in on the what's going on worldwide and a part of everything that's happening to even be aware sometimes of these short, brief little now that's a real brief deal there. I don't even remember having a vote in those. I think that somebody arranged that I wasn't aware it was going to happen. And it would be done and redone in a 4 or 5 day period of time. And there was no real vote. There was not everybody was aware this was going to happen.
One last question for me, Ron, before we get to our last listener question here, but it makes me curious hearing you talk about all this. It's always been said, one of the big rumors, that if David Von Erich hadn't passed away, he would have been NWA world champion, that it was something that meant a lot to Fritz, that Fritz still had a lot of political power at that time, even though Sam Muchnick had already retired. From the best of your memory, was it ever talked about having a Von Erich as a world champion before Kerry won the title after David died? And do you think you would have voted for David Von Erich as NWA champion?
I did not know David very well. Dave and I became friends in Las Vegas. It's probably, or I'm going to guess. I don't. It was about a year before he died. And I don't know exactly what year he died. We spent quite a bit of time on that one NWA meeting together. We went out together a couple of nights, and I really had my first interaction with David. There's a picture floats around on the internet of David and I and Jim Barnett between the two of us. You know, and David was a big guy, like me, same size, maybe a little shorter than I was, but basically pretty much the same size. And, I had a lot of appreciation for his dad. His dad and my dad wrestled against each other quite a bit in Atlanta when I was 16, 17 years old. And I watched a lot of matches with Fritz and Dad. I really thought Fritz had great ability. His boys undisputably had great ability. I never got to see David in an actual match. So, you know, I was not privy to any of the conversations in which David was mentioned. He was young, in my opinion, and that you can't discount somebody for being young, but there's something about winning that belt in which you need the years and the experience to handle the job, and that to me was always a strong point, to put a younger person in charge of that responsibility is a great, there's probably no greater responsibility than putting that belt on and wearing that sucker.
We have one more question here this week, Ron. It's from Stephanie Martin in Spokane, Washington. Do you think it would benefit the new generation of wrestlers to learn the art of shoot wrestling? And I think that's a loose term that a lot of people could apply a lot of different ways. So shoot wrestling, I guess, would also assume being able to hook someone, an old art that you actually learned in the snake pit, Ron.
Yes. And gosh, that's a great question. That's a good one. That strikes me right off the bat is, how can you be a great baseball player if you never played baseball? How can you be a great race car driver if you've never driven a car? How can you be a great wrestler if you know nothing about the basics of the business, of what it's all about? And I wanted to know that. I just felt that, you know, I'm a wrestler, and in order to be a wrestler, I need to know as much about this as I possibly can. And there's a world of difference between being a shooter and being a great worker. And it was not absolutely necessary, even in my day in the 70s and early in 70s. I'm a young guy. I've just changed territories from Georgia to Florida. I don't have to be a great shooter to be able to make it and to be a big name. It's just something I personally wanted to do. I knew the opportunity was there. I could go down there and I could shoot with some of the greats and learn something that I really felt would benefit me. And I felt it would benefit me in several ways. One, I would have movement in the ring that had a little bit of that look to it. And when you shoot, everything is speed. It's speed. It's technique. It's things that it's totally different than wrestling, the normal wrestling move, but it's something I tried to incorporate a little bit of it into what I did because I felt like it was important. And I felt like that I might need it. you know, wrestling's a funny business. I mean, you get in that ring, you travel around the world, you go in that ring with people you don't know anything about, and you don't know what's could happen in there. And sometimes it all goes sour. Sometimes things don't work out, and there's actual animosity in there, and somebody wants to hurt you. And I felt like, you know, I may get in that position someday, and by golly, if somebody's going to get hurt, it ain't going to be me. And that's kind of why I went there quite a bit to the snake pit, is because I wanted to be able to take care of myself. There's another benefit comes instantly to mind, is everybody knows you're there. That's even better than being able to do it, is guys know you were in that snake pit. And as years went on, I got so much benefit about that, out of that, I'm sure, because I'm sure there were guys that didn't like what I was doing. They didn't like me. They would like to have tried me, so to speak, to just see if, you know, can I hurt you or can I beat you? Am I a better man than you? And I think they backed off because that they said, this guy's been the snake pit, you know? And, so that's a tremendous question. And, but in answer to it, you know, how can you make it to the NFL if you never played football? I mean, the sport is wrestling. It's called wrestling. That's what it is. I felt like you needed to be able to do some actual wrestling. You needed to have the basics of the sport inside you and a knowledge of it.
To tie this into the earlier conversation, did you ever talk to Robert about this? Because he goes to Nashville, he goes to Tennessee booking office, a very different style of wrestling. You're in Florida, not just working that Florida style, but in the snake pit, learning how to shoot, learning how to hook. What was that like when you would talk to your brother about those different experiences you guys had?
Rob was like, are you kidding? He was like, why? Why do you go there, man? Why do you do that? Why would you want to do that? He could not. His perspective was different than mine, and it, part of that had to do with I've explained earlier in this program is I went to a wrestling territory, and he went to a fighting territory, to a territory in which they didn't do any wrestling. I mean, practically none in some of the instances. There was no wrestling in their matches whatsoever, and he didn't want it. And not only him, I was surprised at how few people took advantage of that opportunity. There was really only four or five of us in there on a regular basis that would show up and even do it. And some guys, Dick Murdoch, we just talked about him. I remember Dusty and Dick would come in and we would be shooting and they would sit down in the chairs and go, what are you idiots doing? What are you dummies doing up there? You know, I mean, their opinion was kind of like my brother's. It's like, you don't need that. That ain't going to do any good for you. You're never going to get anywhere with that. Well, you know, it just depended on how your mind, what your perspective was. And my perspective was that shooting is something to do with the actual art of this business that we were all going to be in, and that I might can use some of this someday. I might need to have been in the snake pit, and I at least went there and did it.
And we will hear more stories about Ron in Florida, specifically the snake pit, on future Studcast. But as we begin to wrap things up, a few notes here, a few in-house notes. You can still get the Andre the Giant 2-hour Super Studcast and the rest of the story, as well as the Ron Wright 2-hour Super Studcast and the rest of the Ron Wright story at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast for only $2.99 for 3 hours of fantastic content on either wrestler. And don't forget the next Super Studcast, Sunday, March 11th, 2018. We'll talk all about the Devil's Triangle, the Bahamas, and the Caribbean Islands. I know everyone can't wait to hear the Tennessee Stud talk about this one.
Yeah, it's, you know, Gosh, it's an unbelievable part of my life, and it's pretty close to where we're talking about right now. And one of the few first places I start to travel is into the Caribbean. I actually call this episode Caribbean Chaos. That's exactly what it is when you wrestled down there back in the early 70s. It's the most chaotic place on earth. Things happen in those arenas and in those sports stadiums that you'll never see. And people will listen to this broadcast and they'll go, that's unbelievable. And it is truly unbelievable what happened there. And I love it. The stories from the Bahamas and from San Juan. We're going to talk Puerto Rico. We're going to talk Freeport in the Bahamas. We might even get into the Cayman Islands if we don't run out of time. If they're a wrestling fan and they want to hear something that they just will blow their minds, this is the Super Stud Cast for them, because this is true wrestling history as never before told. I don't know if anybody tells these stories. And I know a lot of guys that were there with me and a part of that, but I love telling these stories because they are just so outrageous that people will, their mouths will drop at home and they will tell these stories to their friends. I guarantee you that.
Once again, the next Super Studcast, Sunday, March 11th, 2018, Caribbean Chaos. You can go to patreon.com/studcast or tnstud.com, only $2.99. Of course, you could follow the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller on Twitter and Instagram at Ron Fuller Welch. You can like the Tennessee Stud's Facebook page, Ron Fuller the Tennessee Stud. And please check out the website tnstud.com for your weekly studcast and the Super Studcast and the rest of the story. Take a ride through the stud store and order your studcast t-shirt. It looks great. That beautiful Travis Heckle artwork on this t-shirt. You can get it at tnstud.com, as well as personal autograph photos of the Tennessee Stud. Check out the phenomenal photo gallery and much more, including future events and more information at tnstud.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last, and you can hear me each and every week on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com, available on iTunes, Stitcher, Podcast Addict, and everywhere else. Ron Fuller Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud, I'm the Great Brian Last. Next week, the story continues.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.